I'm just going to use that on the dust jacket of my next book. It was a beautiful introduction. Thank you so much for that. Midge invited me to speak, she mentioned that once again you were this weekend going to be wrestling with the whole matter of where we went wrong and race relations in the since the 60s, certainly. So I thought that's what I would try to focus on. I'm just finishing a book on white guilt. So we're going to talk about white guilt tonight, one way or another. But I actually do think it has some relevance to what... question of where America went wrong in the 60s, but I hope that a small part of it might be relevant. I began to sort of think about this problem back not long ago when President Clinton was going through the Monica Lewinsky affair or whatever. But at any rate, the whole national crisis that this sexual indiscretion put us through. And I remember hearing on the radio, and I remember this when I was a kid also, that someone said that President Eisenhower, back in the 50s, was heard to have used the N-word on the golf course. And I don't know whether this is true or not, or whether this is urban legend. In the black community where I grew up, made a ripple. We didn't really assume otherwise. If there were reporters around, they did nothing about it. And it sort of made me wonder if Eisenhower, back in the 50s, had a sexual affair with a young 21-year-old intern, and we knew all of those details, my guess is that he would have been out of office in a week or two, that America simply would not have tolerated that kind of an indiscretion in the 1950s. On the other hand, he could say the N-word, and America really wouldn't care. It wouldn't make the newspapers. Then sort of conversely, if for some reason we had a tape of President Clinton when he was with Monica or not with Monica, and President Clinton had used the N-word, and so we had it on tape. It played 24-hour channel cable news shows, the President of the United States using that word. My guess is that he would have not lasted a week or two at the very most. On the other hand, he did survive a flagrant, salacious sexual indiscretion. Though he was impeached, he stayed in office. So the point is that we have moral tests in any society that we apply to people who want to hold power, and we say if you meet these moral tests, then you have legitimacy and you have the authority to remain in power and hold the public trust. And it seems to me that in the times that we live, that we've seen a real reversal, so that today social morality, what you think about other groups, racism, bigotries of all kinds, are vastly more important. And in this area of morality, we are absolutely puritanical. We are more puritanical than as certainly puritanical as we have ever been in enforcing this moral code. And if you violate it, you are banished. Trent Lott is a relatively recent example of someone who was at one moment at the pinnacle of power and then sort of reduced instantly to being a backbencher because of an indiscretion that crossed social morality. And so America, in effect, said, you don't have the kind of legitimacy, moral legitimacy, that we expect in someone of your position, and so you will be banished. And not only will you be banished, but there'll be no redemption for you, and nobody wants to be near you, and no one wants to be in a photograph with you, and you are now on the periphery. We're not going to kick you out entirely, but you no longer will have much say in national affairs. On the other hand, we say that the President of the United States, who has an affair with a 21-year intern, is just fine. Characterological virtue of that is based in character and has to do with the individual, we now are very sophisticated about and very tolerant and open-minded about and maybe even a little European about. But again, we are puritanical about social morality. What's interesting to me is Freud talks about this in Civilization of Discontents. You can judge societies by where they apply repression, where they repress people and where they don't. And certainly we've had a kind of reversal of repression where we now do repress people in the area of social morality, but not in the area of character-based morality. How did we get here? How did we get from the Eisenhower era to the Clinton era? How did this reversal of our focus happen? I think it goes back to the civil rights movement. I think it has to do with race, which is the deepest schism in our history as a society. And I think it begins there. By no means is that the only area that contributed to this change. But I think it did begin there. And I would locate it actually beginning in around 1963, 64, 65, the sort of March on Washington through the 64 Civil Rights Bill, the 65 Voting Rights Act. And I think there was an event that occurred there at that time in our history that has been interestingly unexamined. It seems to me we've not spent much time on it at all. And I think that's where the whole business of where we went wrong, I think, began. I think what happened in those years was that the United States of America, after almost four centuries of slavery and segregation, practiced in a country that was explicitly a model of democracy to the world, so that everyone in that country had democratic values, had an idea of individual freedom, individual rights. In that society, these extraordinary wrongs were committed century in and century out. And all of a sudden, at that point in American history, America acknowledged it. I sort of call this the for lack of a better term, the Great Acknowledgement. I think it's one of a seminal event in late 20th century American life, if not in all of our history. The Civil Rights Bill, Voting Rights Acts are formal pieces of legislation that in fact acknowledge that America has practiced what by its own principles constitutes a human evil. And that many, many, many millions of people had suffered because of it, and that America now was owning up to it and wanted to change. So on the one hand, this may have been America's greatest moment. Certainly no other society in human history that I'm aware of has, in a time of peace, confronted itself in this way and acknowledged on this scale, its history and its betrayal of its own principles, for no good reason, really. And so I think only a great society would be capable of doing what America did in the early and mid-60s. I think it was a great moment. I am proud of America for what it did then, for this self-confrontation and this determination, really, to change, to be a different kind of society, to move beyond this old, embedded, habitual evil of segregating people and limiting human opportunity and so forth and so on, purely on the basis of skin color. So I think it was a moment of real greatness, and personally, I'm thankful for it. Growing up, I didn't know if it would ever come, and I was rather surprised to see it did come, but it did. On the other hand, when you acknowledge a wrong, and this is where I think we understandably did not have as much foresight as we might have had, but when you acknowledge a wrong like that, and one that's that serious, and that has injured that many people and contradicted your values for so long, a wrong on that kind of almost unimaginable scale, the price, it seems to me, that you pay, and I think that has Americans have paid, is that you lose your moral authority around race, around anything having to do with race. And I think that the first, and still with us, I think even today, the most powerful result of this great acknowledgement has been this loss of moral authority. And in many ways also, which the two terms are almost interchangeable, legitimacy. And this particularly, as I'll talk about in a minute, I think has affected our institutions and so forth. But this is what America did not foresee, is that all of a sudden, they had no moral authority. The people who ran the country, who were still, of course, whites, had no moral authority. This lack of moral authority, this disappearance, vanishing of it overnight, is what I call white guilt. Is not, again, not remotely a guilt having to do with any sort of guilt of conscience or any feeling of anguish or anything over the suffering of it. Nothing. If that was white guilt, I don't think it would be a very big thing. Because I don't think people feel white guilt on a, very often at any rate, on a personal level. I can't get up in the morning, I'm so guilty about our history, and I don't think that's realistic. But I think all white people in America today do live with a vacuum of moral authority, with a timidity around racial issues, with a fear, with an anxiety, that if they speak, they're going to put their foot in their mouth, they're going to make a mistake, they're going to be somehow identified with that racist past, and they're going to be stigmatized with it, and we're going to say, you're a racist. This anxiety, again, is a part of white guilt and how it works. This guilt works, I think, in exactly the same way that racism itself worked. Racism worked by stigma. If you were black, you were stigmatized, and you had to live the life that blacks were allowed to live, and you had to follow the patterns of restriction and so forth. You have the and no matter who you were, because the stigma was indifferent to your individuality. It had no interest in your individuality whatsoever. And so the stigma was, if you're black and you're inferior, that's it. And so you can't eat here, and you can't buy a house there, and you can't so forth and so on. You have the image I always think of as poignant of Duke Ellington having to sit in the kitchen of the hotels that his band, his orchestra, played in to eat, unable to go into the restaurant. America, probably America's, arguably at any rate, America, the greatest American composer of the 20th century, had to do that certainly for the majority of his career, and the stories of that go on and on. Why? because the stigma was indifferent to the fact that this was a great man. It didn't care. He was a black man, and that was the end of it. This white guilt works in exactly the same way. Doesn't care who you are. Doesn't care whether you what your feelings are about blacks or what, if you knew one when you were. It doesn't care. You're white, and you have no authority upon which to, out of which to speak. And you may have never had the slightest sort of impulse toward racism, but it doesn't matter. A white child, I think, born today in the United States of America will live with white guilt because, again, it functions irrationally by stigma. When a child gets to be old enough to know anything at all about American history, that child will be lumped among the whites who, in some way or other, we probably wrongly presume, but presume anyway, benefited from racism. And so now this child who's born today will be on the defensive and will learn to speak in a politically correct way so that he or she never jeopardizes his good name. Well, my point is that this reality of white guilt, the fact that it is so, it can be invoked so instantly and so universally with all people who have white skin, who live inside of America, immigrants who came last week, doesn't matter. Endure this sort of live under this threat of stigmatization. My point is that in itself constitutes an enormous social power in American life. It makes things happen. It determines the way our institutions function. It determines the way we live together with each other, the way, the kind of language we use with each other, because it's a relentless pressure. And it seems to me to be one that has, interestingly, been unexamined. I won't go into everything about it, but one of the things that an offshoot of an aspect of white guilt is what I call white blindness. And it's interesting that one of the great themes in black American literature, you see it in the work of Richard Wright, James Baldwin, certainly I think the greatest articulator of white blindness was Ralph Ellison. But there is this, again, this preoccupation that minorities have that with the blindness of whites, the invisibility of blacks, and so forth. I'll try to come back to that. There is one incident in Ellison's Invisible Man that I think is the best fictional dramatization of white blindness ever written. It's the section that, if you've read the novel, you'll know the Mr. Norton section. And Mr. Norton is a very well-to-do northern philanthropist who comes to this college, small black college in the South, which is sort of a takeoff on Tuskegee. And he is being driven around the campus and gets into all sorts of adventures and troubles, which I won't go into, by the invisible man, by the young black protagonist in the novel. And the invisible man doesn't get this guy, because he's got all sorts of weird things he talks about, one of which is he keeps telling him that, "You are my destiny. You are my destiny, young man." And the invisible man, of course, has absolutely no idea what that means and is perturbed by it. And it's something that's, even in all of the criticism on Ellison, I don't see written very much about. But it is an example of white blindness. And it works like this. White guilt, because whites are in this one-down position of forever having to prove the negative, to prove that they are not racist, that the stigma does not apply to them. What that means, in effect, is that white guilt has placed a contingency on the exercise of white power. Of it has placed a contingency on moral authority and legitimacy. By that I mean it says that you cannot have moral authority. You cannot be a decent American. Your institution cannot have legitimacy. You cannot exercise power until you meet a contingency that proves that you are not racist. In other words, until you somehow, symbolically at the very least, dissociate from racism. You have to dissociate from it. If you do conspicuously dissociate from it, then we'll let you go about your business. I call this white blindness because what it means is that whites, whenever the racial issue comes up or whenever they meet a black, they're under threat. And the thing that they become preoccupied with, I think quite naturally, is not the black person or is not the racial issue, but is their stake in it. How can they make it clear that they're not racist? How can they meet this contingency? What do they have to do, in other words, to dissociate from racism? And so there's the race issue. There's the black person. But the white has got to be primarily focused around his problem is, how in the hell do I dissociate and make it clear that I'm not, and therefore be able to go on about my business and run my institution or whatever. This, I think, is one of the things that Norton in this character means when he keeps saying to the invisible man, "You are my destiny." He's saying, in a sense, I have to do something for you to dissociate myself from the past in order to have legitimacy, in order to have moral authority. I need you. You are my destiny. I cannot function. And he, of course, is a symbol of Northern white America. I cannot function. I will not have legitimacy. Unless, except that I get through you by in some way dissociating from America's racist past. My feeling is that all race-related public policy since the mid-60s, since the beginning of the Great Society, all of it, I believe, is defined by white blindness, which is to say that its purpose has nothing on earth to do with the development or advancement of the minorities who in some way suffered all those centuries of slavery and segregation. It has instead to do solely with the dissociation of whites from the stigma of racism in the past. It is entirely consumed, I think, and defined by white blindness. Most recently, we had the Michigan affirmative action case, and I think makes this point fairly well. Over 100 American institutions submitted briefs to the Supreme Court in favor of racial preferences. 100, more than 100, more than in, I think, the entire history of the court. Well, did they do that because they were just absolutely racked with guilt and anguish over the poor academic performance of black American schoolchildren? Obviously, they were not. Obviously, I don't think that the academic performance, the difficulties that blacks are having in the United States today in assimilating into the academic and intellectual part of our culture, and they're having profound problems there. I don't think that crossed the mind of a single one of those people. I don't think it's mentioned in any one of those 100 briefs that were submitted to the court. What they said simply was, listen, Supreme Court, we've got to have those damn Instagram preferences, because it's the only way we can dissociate ourselves from American history and have the legitimacy to function in American society. It's the only thing that will make the University of Michigan, a state university, legitimate. I don't know whether it's going to help blacks or not. Who cares? It's going to make us a legitimate institution. If, on the other hand, we don't have them, and we have to let blacks in here on the basis of their ability to compete, we won't have enough for legitimacy. We won't have enough to dissociate. And so we have to have it for that reason. You can go through, again, the kind of welfare that came into being in the late 60s and all the way up to welfare reform in the late 90s was a sort, again, a welfare where we'll give you money, we'll give you subsidy to live on, and we will ask absolutely nothing of you. We don't care what you do. We don't care whether you raise your children or not, whether you prepare to get a job, nothing. Just get the money. And then your children, when they have the first baby, will get their money. They don't have to do anything either. When in human history has a government ever given to people basically a subsistence living, a little better, and ask absolutely why the failure to ask anything? Because then white America would have crossed that line and confirmed the fact that they're racist. And no such policy they would not dissociate from racism. They would, in fact, seem to be agreeing with it. And so, again, a form of welfare devoted entirely to this the need of white Americans to dissociate from racism. Of course, I don't think there was any single worse policy in American history than that welfare. I think it created the black underclass, destroyed the black family in ways that segregation was never able to, took every incentive away from people to be decent human beings in any way. There was no degree of failure that you could go that would cut your money off. The incentive basically was to fail. Well, it was obviously a cruel and thoughtless policy that conforms perfectly to white blindness, because the minorities were invisible. They were never thought about. No one saw them. And what, again, invisibility is a failure to see the human problems of people across racial lines. The failure to see them as human beings. The failure is to simply say, for example, that obviously coming from the kind of deprivations that blacks had come in many cases, not in all, but in many, there would be a great need for development, for even, dare one say, assimilation into the sort of values that enable one to thrive in a free and democratic society. But President Johnson, when he's coming out with this great society, and so could he stand there and say, look, you're behind. You can't read as well. You can't write as well. You haven't been taught. You got a lot of work to do. If you get busy, you'll see. It's not that difficult. You'll be fine, and you'll be competitive as human beings. And what you need most of all is to feel that you are competitive with the other citizens in your society. And so we're going to ask that, if we're going to demand that of you, and above all, and it is, human life sometimes is ironic. Yes, it's too bad you got oppressed and that now you got to work harder, but the fact is you were oppressed and now you have to work harder, and you have to learn things that you didn't know before, and so forth and so on. Well, again, rather than do that, what America said is, we'll throw things at them. We'll give them racial preferences and ask nothing. They don't even, when they get the racial preference and they get on the college campus, we don't even say you have to have a certain grade point average to keep the preference. We don't even say that. We don't ask anything of the welfare mother. We don't, and so forth. And of course, now this is in the sort of rarefied territory of diversity. So that now, it's interesting because diversity is really a fascinating example because there hasn't been any discrimination in American universities for over 50 years. You can't justify a racial preference on the basis of actual discrimination. You're harming these people, you're keeping them out, so forth. There's got to be redress. There's no redress here because there's been no discrimination. The only discrimination has been in favor of minorities. So then how do you justify the preference? So they invented diversity. Oh, we've discovered that if you don't have a critical mass of black students in, the intellectual quality of discussion goes down. There's absolutely no evidence to support that, but the point is that the institution is saying, damn it, we're going to have our preferences because we need them to dissociate from the past and to claim our moral authority and our legitimacy. And so if there's no discrimination, we'll invent something and we'll call it diversity. And we'll do it that way. And that's what we're now at. So now you have redress for no wrong. You have policies that are supposed to remedy something that hasn't been there in 50 years. So you're remedying nothing. But again, the institution needs it for the dissociation. Well, I think white blindness has given us this new social virtue that I started out referring to. Called a kind of virtue of dissociation, and it is very different from the kind of virtue we cared about back before this great. Sort of divide these two periods, so I'm trying to create drama here as I'm writing about them. Into the age of racism and the age of white guilt, and the acknowledgement is sort of the dividing point. We live now, I think, in the age of white guilt, where we need, our society needs, a new idea of virtue that will again enable us to dissociate, enable people in that society, institutions in that society, to dissociate and reclaim their legitimacy. So the old kind of virtue, where you're just a good person, is based in the individual, in individual responsibility and self-restraint and initiative and all that sort of thing. Those virtues are of secondary importance now because they don't reclaim moral authority. They don't dissociate. So if you're good now and you stay married to your wife and raise your kids, so what? It doesn't make a contribution to this dissociation, to this moral authority that we now must have. And so we don't really care. What we care about, again, is that you're able to dissociate. This virtue has, I'll just mention four quickly characteristics that I think it has. The first one is, you're all familiar with, social engineering. One of the things that is now deigned to be a social good in and of itself is social engineering, is engineering populations, is creating diversity. This is thought to be now, if you support that, again, you earn your dissociation and your moral authority and you're a good person, you can go about your business. If you don't support social engineering, you then... Boom, the stigma comes down on you. You are now identified with racist America, and that's that. Second quality is also, I think, familiar, moral relativism, where, you know, this again, everybody's culture is just as good as everybody else's culture. Everything is just as good. And when you see minority groups involved in oftentimes pathological behavior, that's okay because that's their culture and that's their, and so there's this sort of tolerance of virtually everything any kind of baby. The illegitimacy rate today in Black America is still hovering around 70%. So, boy, isn't that a scandal? Isn't that a horrible thing? But you can't say that. Because, again, it's moral relativism, and we, boy, that's just a mark of the tragic history of slavery and segregation and so forth. Though, of course, the legitimacy rates in segregation and even slavery were nowhere near that high. But again, your tolerance, your moral relativism around minority issues, your loosey-goosey sort of attitude wins you moral authority, makes you a virtuous person, a good American. I support affirmative action. I'm a good American. If you say you don't support it, then of course you're a bad one. A third feature is called deference and license toward minorities. You defer to their greater moral authority, and you offer them a license not to meet the same requirements and standards as other people, as whites. Again, preferences are the perfect means of that. You lower the standards, you offer them a license not to to have to struggle and work as hard as others. Because again, this shows that you're sensitive to the tragedy of their past, and it dissociates you from the past. A last feature of this new virtue, interestingly, I think, is anti-Americanism in itself. Anti-Americanism as a virtue, as a source of virtue for white Americans. If you don't like America, if you say America has at its core an impulse to evil, to oppression, to imperialism, etc., etc., you are a good person. You are a better person than someone who works hard and raises their family and so forth. Because what better way to dissociate from America's racist path than to say America is at its very core evil? And we've got to really sit down on it and watch it. So interestingly, in this sense, anti-Americanism becomes a means of political power in our society, because the people who espouse anti-Americanism have an irrefutable virtue. They are above America's past. They dissociate from America's racism and its bigotry and its sexism and so forth. They hate all of that. And they hate even the country that did that. And they are the future of this country. And they deserve to be elected to office. and so forth and so on, because they hate America. That's a virtue in and of itself. Of itself, because it's so dissociational. It makes them so clean of America's past, so pure of America's past. And so that too now is a part of this new, I think, this new sort of virtue that we live with. At least a mild nodding anti-Americanism is helpful to you in American society. Particularly if you run institutions in American society, corporations even, universities certainly, government agencies, suspicious this country is just, they just couldn't wait to go, and you all know the litany very well, we just couldn't wait to go in around the world and just do something nasty and evil to people. To take their oil and to disregard their culture, and on and on. Because again, that person then becomes more virtuous, dissociates from all that past evil, and is now got the moral authority and the legitimacy to rightfully claim power. So you see people like, obviously, Michael Moore and others who've made a high art out of this by tapping this sort of dissociational virtue. And all you don't have to think or anything. You just hate America and so forth. Well, just a couple little quick ones, and then I'll shut up and we can talk. I think to some degree, this whole problem, this particular kind of virtue that is just based on a dissociation from the evils of the past, is now spread throughout the Western world almost entirely. Certainly all of those, the great European powers of the past have colonialism behind them, have Nazism behind them, and so forth. So now they too seem to me to have found a kind of source of real power in anti-Americanism. They've sort of projected all the last four or five centuries of white evil onto America, and they now dissociate and dislike us and see our president as a cowboy and see us as a sort of a unilateralist imperialist who want to rape and pillage the world. And it has, I think, transformed into real power in many European societies today. Anti-Americanism in itself is a virtue. It makes you a good person and more suitable to have to hold power. I think another kind of example in the current presidential race is, you try to look at what the difference between John Kerry and George W. Bush's policy on Iraq is, and what you basically see is that John Kerry is sort of saying, I'm going to do about the same thing, but I'm going to live within the parameters of white guilt. I'm going to be nuanced, and I'm going to be sensitive. I'm going to be sensitive, especially sensitive. In other words, I'm going to dissociate. I'm going to dissociate from the ugliness of Western life, and I'm going to do it in a new sort of, in a new multilateral bureaucratic way. It is in a sense his rationale for taking power, is that he will be a good white person, who will not be that ugly, foaming at the mouth racist that his opponent clearly is. He hopes that'll work. I don't know. It's certainly gotten him fairly far. How far this will work and how long this will go on, I don't know. But I do think that this is a kind of an outline of at least one of the ways that we have gone wrong without. Because we've, again, not paid attention. There's another whole side of this in terms of how minorities have reacted, how we have formed our identity around protesting and protesting and protesting and protesting, because we keep trying to get whites to dissociate, to throw us little crumbs like preferences and so forth. And so we then create a whole identity around that we think will get us those crumbs. And, of course, in the process, we just keep ourselves in this posture of victimization and weakness and inferiority. The very stigma that we ought to be, obviously, overcoming. So there is this, again, a kind of, seems to me, a symbiosis that both sides have gotten hooked in to. I'll stop there. Take some questions. Thank you. Thank you. I guess I am going to take some questions. So, anybody who has a. Yes, sir?
How would you analyze Bill Cosby's rather public
Well, I think the only thing that's new about it is that it's Bill Cosby, who's more famous than probably any other black, or certainly most other blacks, and so and is well loved because he's a comedian and so forth. I think that again, he broke the rule. He broke out of this symbiosis. He didn't play his part. One thing you cannot do is you cannot ask anything of minorities. That is the cardinal rule of all of this. The minute you ask something of minorities, then of course you're a racist. You're connected to that past. You're stigmatized as a racist, and you'll be stopped. You won't go anywhere. One of the cardinal rules on the other side, the black side, is that you never, ever, ever, under any circumstances, say that kind of thing in front of white people. Don't you understand? We're trying to keep them on the hook. We're trying to keep them dissociating. That's our future. Is how I think sick and pathetic it is. Our future is entirely dependent on the crumbs they throw us. And so you jeopardize our future by saying we can do it ourselves. It's a sick symbiosis, it has profoundly injured Black America. I don't think Black America has ever been this lost in all of our history here in America, including during slavery. I think we were clearer headed then, new reality better then, and I think it's both of our faults. I think whites have to stop this obsession with dissociating from racism and say what they believe. And blacks have to understand that you can't advance an entire race of people on the guilt of another group. You have to become productive in the same way that group is. We're not there. But, you know, every now and then you get somebody like Crosby who makes a mistake and speaks out. My sense is that he will go back inside the church and behave himself, or he'll try to find a way to do it. If he keeps saying these things as he's saying them now, he will be ostracized, and he will be isolated and injured, as all blacks are who say black Americans are not victims. We're just not victims. So he's at high risk. I don't know why. I don't know what he had in mind. Whether he has any sort of sense of how he might continue in this way. Certainly, he's somebody who could have enormous impact if he chose to. But he'd pay a price certainly in his career and otherwise. But what does he care at this point? He's obviously not a poor man. So there's hope with him. And it seems to me. But he'll go. The dynamic is in place. He's just an individual, and he will get, even as famous and rich as he is, he'll get eaten up by it, and we'll see whether or not he can continue to walk through it. Yes. Well, thank you. I think there are a lot of things we certainly can do. I didn't talk about that, but the problem that black Americans, it seems to me, have, and it's a problem that any group, anywhere in the world, I think it's a problem in the Mideast, when you had this long history of having been sat upon and oppressed and so forth. Then you come out, and you come out into the modern world. I call it the sort of problem of emergence. How do we emerge? We were slaves. We were segregated. All opportunities were limited and so forth. And so the problem, it seems to me, we keep thinking it's civil rights. Civil rights, as far as I'm concerned, was solved in 64, 65. The problem now is emergence. How do you emerge and become a part of modernity, of the modern world? And how do you become competitive in that world so that you are truly competing with everybody else? It seems to me that's the goal, period. Well, I think the first thing you do is recognize that that's the goal. The goal is not to just keep beating drums about civil rights and affirmative action and these little, bitty, tiny, insignificant, pathetic things that have, if they were going to do something, God knows they would have done it by now. But we're, you know, I read in the Thurnstons books, the Thurnstons are out here somewhere, black students did worse on the SAT exam in the year 2000 than they did in the year 1990. So with all of these things, we're if not declining, we're certainly not doing very well in relation to other people. And again, I've written talk a lot about why I think that the identity and the we don't yet know. We have to compete. So I think the first thing is that we have to acknowledge that we have to compete with everybody else. That's why I hate preferences, is because they literally forbid competition between blacks. It is a public policy that forbids blacks from open competition with their peers. It disallows. It won't let them do it. And it continues to destigmatize them as inferior. And it is a shameful, shameful public policy. It is disgusting in every way. And it should be rejected by every black. And we should have a movement to reject it. Because, again, all these policies that are in our name don't do anything but help whites dissociate from racism. But you ask a different kind of question. I think, first of all, we have to do that, to recognize that this is the direction we have to go, is to become competitive with everybody else, which means the first thing is that we have to embrace assimilation. We have to become not some sort of unique, we don't need to reinvent the wheel and become some unique human black group. What would that be? We need to join the mainstream of Western culture and Western civilization and become competitive in it. And if we can bring along something unique from our own culture, I'm sure we will, to enhance that larger one, then fine. That's all for good. But, you know, as I say, this will get people upset with me. The best way for blacks to get ahead is to, number one, stop thinking of yourself as black. How can we ask other people not to think of us as black all the time and ascribe all sorts of things to us if we constantly are trying forever to make something out of it? There's nothing to be made out of. We're just human beings. We were victimized by race. We'll always be victimized by race. It's something we ought to be the last ones holding on to it. So if you all of a sudden aren't thinking of yourself as a black, you just simply look across the street and you say, how is John over there getting ahead? What is he doing? And you know, the more segregated we become, the more cut off we become from the mainstream, the worse we do. Because we get more and more out of touch of what it takes to move ahead. I think we ought to think of ourselves as Americans and as individuals. And our racial identity is something that we don't owe a lot to. What do we owe a lot to that for? It's not a religion. It was used to oppress us in the first place. What do we owe a lot to that for? What if we got to make something whoopee and wonderful out of blackness? Let's just do well and compete as Americans in the society. And I don't have to be black, and you don't have to be black. And if you come out as Jesse Jackson does and say, well, this is what it means to be black, not with me. Who is he to tell me that? We're not a nation. None of that really applies. So let's just take that baggage and put it down and compete as Americans.
Can I ask you to doing anything but helping whites dissociate.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that's entirely right. Maybe you could expand a bit on the state that those that today are in the forefront of black leadership have those policies.
I didn't hear the last part.
The state that those who are held up these days as leaders of the black community, uh-huh. The state that they have in those policies.
Oh. Well, sure. You see this all over the world in, again, groups that have been oppressed, and now the Western culture is left, and is now they're in their repentant mode, they're in their white guilt mode, and so forth, and they're throwing crumbs, and they're usually throwing them to a little tiny cobble of minority leaders. In America, it's the civil rights community. In every African nation has the same little cobble of people at the top who are taking all the goodies from the World Bank and so forth. And then they never really get down, but they justify their position by saying, as the civil rights movement does, we're getting racial preferences for you. And so, you know, no one ever elected these people. Again, we're not a nation. I don't know why the NAACP thinks it represents all of black America. I don't know under what authority it works. But again, they are this sort of they keep the symbiosis going because they're the ones who are constantly trading. And you noticed around Bill Cosby on the stage when he made these remarks was Jesse Jackson and who else was there? Well, I won't name a bunch of names, but civil rights leaders, nervous, just very nervous. Well, why? Because obviously... He's threatening the food on their table, and yet they don't. He's so famous they need him. He's so well loved in broad America that they need him. So they're nervous, and there is always this. Call in my last book, The Grievance Industry. It's that the people who make leaderships of minority groups all around the world that thrive off of white guilt. They set up the market. They say, look, Michigan, Harvard, whatever, this is what you got to do. And in order to dissociate, if you don't dissociate, if you say that you want to see better work from Cornell West at Harvard, you're racist, and Harvard University's racist, and we'll come down on you like a ton of bricks. And so suddenly Harvard University finds a new affection for Cornell West and for other blacks. Another black faculty I just read recently was turned, lost, didn't get tenure there. Though she was embraced by Stanford, came in with a tenured position at Stanford. And her work is on hip-hop music. Well, Lawrence Summers is being heavily criticized at this moment for not giving her tenure. The point is that this leadership is that what we have as minorities have done is we see this great sort of open maw of white neediness, and we know they need us. We know we are their destiny, as Mr. Norton said, and so the black leadership has just opened up shop. And if whites said tomorrow morning, because whites, remember, control everything. If they said tomorrow morning, we're going to now treat you as individuals, as American citizens, they'd be out of business by tomorrow afternoon. The NAACP, if the NAACP had to function on money it got from the pockets of black people, it would have been dead 40 years ago. Black people don't contribute money to it. It's all corporate money. It's all white guilt money. Because white guilt, all those institutions that submitted those dossiers or briefs to the court, they are the ones who want to have. I gotta go someplace and buy some immunity, buy some dissociation, and this is a pretty cheap price. So it just sort of keeps going around that way, I think.
Well,
Well, it's interesting because, you know, we're one of the very first multiracial societies in human history. And, you know, there are not a lot that we can look back at their history of evolution and see how they worked it all out. So I don't know. It seems to me that we're pretty locked in right now to this. And we've got a long way to go. I don't think, remember. Well, I would agree. I would agree. I think, obviously, the more of that, the better. The problem is that those same white students, the minute they get out and they get in positions of authority in American life, they run a law firm, they run this business, or they are the head of a government agency. Instantly, they will start going along with the whole thing, and somebody will appear at their door. Some Jesse Jackson look-alike will appear at their door, and they will be caught up in the whole thing, even though they know good and well it's ridiculous. It's not that whites don't know it's ridiculous.
So in other words, what you're saying is that our society base is controlled by a certain amount of autonomy that is coming in through business and corporation, that they have to maintain the order to set it in college today and come out and become a lawyer, and you join a large law firm, and his senior partner tell him, say, we have three black kids, three Afro-American kids in the firm. Be careful of how you talk to them because we get federal government money. In order for us to do this, we have to keep them here and the company. So we're not looking at society what I understand today as individuals, but we're looking at society the way that economics is controlled of society to keep things going.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah, I'd very much agree with that. Diversity is good business, as they all say. That's their little working cliche. Diversity is good for business. Yes, it is. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes, there's some people here I know probably know the numbers on that better than I do. But generally speaking, blacks from the Caribbean, blacks from Africa, do very well in American life and as a group and are competitive. And there is a tension between them and African Americans, black Americans. And because they don't quite understand the politics and so forth. And so there is a kind of tension. But they make the point that racism is not the barrier it once was in American life, that blacks can do very well now in this society. They assimilate. They have something to offer. Yes, that's interesting. Yeah. That's an interesting point. Not to mention black conservatives. But, you know, white conservatives, by definition, don't want to play this game. They don't want to, they don't believe in that list of things I said, all of this new virtue of social engineering and moral relativism. And they don't, that's antithetical to their worldview. So they are, by definition, racist. Conservatives, in this scheme of things, are by definition racist. And so they have a bigger, taller mountain. It'd be better if you're white, be a Democrat. And that helps a little bit in terms of getting that stigma off. But they're under a very difficult situation, and I think a stunning example to me was George Bush's phrase, "compassionate conservatism," because why the word "compassionate conservatism" all of a sudden, out of nowhere? Who said it wasn't compassionate? There was no what point are you making? He is dissociating himself from the America's history of racism. It's a dissociational word that where he's signaling to the entire society, I too, even though I'm a conservative, even though I too hate that ugly racist past. And if you thought conservatives were racist in the past, let me tell you, there's a new one now, and we're compassionate. We're not like, we're basically, he said, I'm not a racist conservative. And I think that if he had not used that word, he wouldn't be president today. I think if that word explains his presidency, that single word. Not because it got him more black votes, which it didn't, because they don't like that, they do not like the idea of a conservative trying to say that he's not racist and that he's actually compassionate and actually has a social conscience of some kind. They don't like that because they're never going to be able to deal with conservatives like they deal with liberals. And so they hate George Bush for that reason. But nevertheless, the ingenious move on Bush's part was to use that word to dissociate, because conservatives are just up against that stigma, much more so than other whites. It is as conservative sort of means we long for those old days of segregation and when people knew their place and so forth. That's the stigma. Conservatives say, well, I don't feel that way. And there you sense this frustration in conservative groups. What the hell do we do? How do we, without betraying everything we believe in and stand for, how do we become players in this in the game? How do we? Because this phony idea, this is one thing that's interesting, is that this idea of virtue as dissociational and so forth is now the establishment. It was in the 60s the counterculture. The counterculture became the establishment. And now traditional values, virtue grounded in character, these people are all dissenters. Conservatives are now in the posture of dissent. So it's going to be a hard struggle, I think, for conservatives. I'm not sure Bush's tact is going to be effective in the long run. But I think the worst, and I see, sadly, George Bush supporting racial preferences. He's saying, look, I got to live here in America. I got to be giving these black people something. I've got to, in order to dissociate, I've got to... you know, browbeat poor Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell. Every time I speak, I got to say, they're in my cabinet. Think about how horrible that must be to have their name invoked constantly as an emblem of George Bush's compassion, his will to dissociate. And it is ugly. I'm disappointed in Bush for that. I think he maybe he didn't feel he had the mandate, he had a war in his hands, I don't know. But to me, he lost a great opportunity with this preference issue. And I hold it against him. And I hope he does better in the future because it's infinitely more important than I think he realizes. It really is central to our culture and this whole long history that we've had. And I wish for more from him. Yes.
How do you think the Jesse Jacksons of the world came to be spokesmen for the black community?
They just pushed themselves forward. They weren't elected.
The question also is, how do you find that, kind of thinking that you're
Because, see, let me give you a better answer to that. Let me give you two. The Jesse Jacksons are the leaders of the black community because of white blindness. Whites don't see blacks. So Jesse Jackson appears at the door. Every white person around, he's their leader. They would never do that with a white man. They would never say, with a white man, they'd say, well, where's your constituency? How much power do you really have? Where do you get your money? Who are you? With Jesse Jackson, they don't say a word. Because again, they're not interested. As I said, when they see the black or they see the racial problem, they become obsessed with dissociating and recovering their own moral authority and legitimacy. And Jesse Jackson, just like Bledsoe and Invisible Man, because what this means is that black people are always wearing a mask because they know whites are blind. And so they just basically look at whites and they say, what are they buying today? Well, it used to be they were buying Booker T. Washington, who was more humble. That was a mask. Now they're buying black militancy. They want only the angry blacks. They don't want to bring Thomas Sowell to deal with him. They want only the angry blacks will vet them and give them the dissociation that the protection from stigma that they're looking for. So Jesse thrives inside. That's Al Sharpton. Who the hell is Al Sharpton? Got a little church somewhere with 400 people, and he's running for the presidency of the United States. You talk of that's white blindness. Black people just laugh. I mean, but white people. He's sitting down having an interview with Tim Russert on Meet the Press that he reserves only for presidential candidates. Al Sharpton. That's white blindness, and Russert's sitting there, blind as a bat, seriously interviewing this man. Seriously interviewing, not saying, who the hell are you? Thank you very much.
Two quick points. We start tomorrow at 8:30. There will be some coffee out in the lobby. Also, the book signing will be taking place out here, and we have a very generous arrangement. If you buy the books, the Philadelphia Society will get half the price of the books as part of our reward. So we appreciate your patronizing that book signing, and we'll see you tomorrow morning.